And the paper with Kevin, we made some choices for convenience, which a posteriori I regret a bit. And one of the choices was to suppress the coupling so that everywhere you just see N, and then you're supposed to recognize if it's a tooth coupling or it's a, or just the size of matrices, because you set the coupling to one. So that's the first thing I don't want to do in these lectures. I want to have both a coupling and an N, so I can point out, ah, that's a tooth coupling. Okay, so you have seen roughly the chiral algebra. How does it look like? Do you need a refresher on how the chiral algebra looks like? Can somebody who's not currently working on the chiral algebra remind us what the chiral algebra looks like? Okay, I think there's a sign that perhaps I should review what the chiral algebra looks like. So, the chiral algebra is a 2D gauged beta gamma system. If you call it beta gamma system, might induce the wrong thoughts. So alternative words can be used, which are perhaps better, is a gauged symplectic bosons. These are more or less the same, but this description, when people say beta gamma system, they tend to treat beta and gammas in different ways. Symplectic bosons is a better name because it makes it clear that they are on an even footing. But perhaps I should start by discussing chiral. 2D chiral okay. So ultimately this is not a theory as much as it is a chiral algebra or vertex operator algebra. So this is a so I have a bunch of holomorphic operators, they have OPEs, they have correlation functions on a sphere, perhaps even, although, but I'm not worrying very much about making sure that the whole thing is self, has unique correlation functions on a Riemann surface or stuff like that. So it's not a 2D theory. It's perhaps a relative theory to something complicated. There are ways to actually pair up an holomorphic and an holomorphic version of these into a theory. I don't know if they're actually relevant for twisted holography. I'm still a bit confused. I would not ignore that. So,
what you just said there, like you said, like you don't care about whether like endpoint functions is well defined.
No, I mean I said I don't care if correlation functions on Riemann surfaces are unique and single valued as I deform the Riemann surface. And it's conceivable that there might be vertex operator module, you know, vertex operators for these vertex modules for the vertex algebra, which for which I could compute correlation functions in a sphere, which are not single valued. So I just, but okay, I'm just saying I'm trying to define a chiral algebra. And it's kind of a 2D theory, but I'm not trying to push the statement too far because it would break. Okay. Now, what does gauged mean? And what does symplectic bosons mean? Symplectic bosons are a very simple theory. Are just the same as free fermions, but bosons. So I have some fields, some indices, and an action which looks like this, and some quantity I put here, like a, you know, some constant matrix I put there, which the name is simpletic follows on the fact that this is an anti-symmetric pairing instead of being a symmetric pairing. For fermions, I would have just put an II, you know, the trivial some symmetric pairing, but because they're bosons, if I put a symmetric thing here, this would be a total derivative. And instead, I need to put something anti-symmetric. And I will put an explicit 1 over h bar because I want the coupling in life. So these are symplectic bosons. And when I write this action, I should really specify what's the dimension of these fields. I want to treat them all in this democratic way. So I'll give them all dimension 1/2. So would you be able to compute correlation functions in this theory or OPEs? Can you tell me the OPE of symplectic bosons?
Z alpha, z beta would be omega alpha beta divided by z minus w. Oh, yeah, probably z.
Okay, that's right. So I'm going to have an h bar.
H bar, yeah, thanks.
I really like these days. I'm going to have the inverse of the symplectic form, and then z minus w. Correct. Same as I would do for a fermion, they're bosons. Okay, and if I want to do correlation function, this is a free theory. Right. So it's not just a chiral algebra, it's a free chiral algebra. Which leads to important simplifications and a few things we need to think about as we proceed. So, what are the local operators in this theory?
Products of sides and the derivatives.
That's right. I can take any polynomial in z, del z, del square z, etc. Okay? Any operator made out of this. Now, how do I multiply things? They're fields. How do I multiply? They when I bring them together, they diverge. So how do I make sense of this?
Normal ordering.
That's correct. So it's a free theory. So this beautiful thing called normal ordering, and I will use it. Implicitly, this is the first and last time I ever write it. Every time I multiply things at the same location, they are normal ordered. Caution, in chiral algebras, there is another definition of normal ordering, of product, which is sometimes called normal order too. Usually not, but you might get reference which make this mistake, where you sort of take the OPE of the fields, and then you throw away all the singular parts. And we call that regularized product. The regularized product is not associative and satisfies some horrible axioms and is not the normal order. Okay? Very important. It has one beautiful property, though, which is that it satisfies Leibniz's rule for symmetries. This doesn't, which will become important momentarily. So, okay, so we understand symplectic boson reasonably well. How do I compute correlation functions? Say, suppose I want to compute something like, I don't know, z1, z2 of z, z3, z1, z2, oh, okay, z alpha, z beta at z. the alpha, the gamma, the delta at W. And if you really want, I can still put the normal order here, but it's really less time. What's the answer?
Just contract pairs.
Yeah, we'll use weak contractions. So we're going to have a term which is going to be z, 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 z. Now, we never contract, because this is already normal order, we never will contract within the normal order. So there will be an answer where we contract like that, and an answer where we contract like that. Okay? So one will give me delta, sorry, h bar squared omega alpha delta omega beta gamma over z minus w squared. And the other term is going to be omega alpha gamma omega beta delta. And this sort of weak contractions could also be described graphically. I could represent this operator as sort of a blob with two legs, and the other operator as a blob with two legs, and then just contracting them in the two possible ways. These pictures have nothing else but Feynman diagrams. And so I will use the language of Feynman diagrams whenever needed or useful. Which again, I can do because it's a free theory. Next, I need to say something about the word gauged. Gauge means that, we're gauging a symmetry. I pick some collection of symplectic bosons which live in a space which is acted upon by some group. And I just want to gauge the symmetry. But if I was to write an action, I would just write the obvious thing. So I should put the omega alphabet inside, probably. Here, I lowered one of the indices of the connection with omega. I should just not write indices at all, but let me just. This is anti-symmetric, this is symmetric. So there's a connection for some symplectic representation of the group. Now, and I'm doing a path integral over the z's and over a bar. Modulo gauge transformations. Now, at this point, to do gauge symmetry, I should now do things properly. I should gauge fix, and I should put insert ghosts, do a nice BRST quantization. Now, what is the gauge symmetry here that I need to gauge? Usually, I would say, well, I just gauge functions on the group, gauge transformation by some group G. But only the anti-homomorphic part of the connection enters the action. So if you complexify your gauge transformations, let's say this properly. So you really want to throw all the gauge transformations which do not like the gauge group is bigger than you might have expected. A little bit bigger. But anyway, it doesn't matter. I don't want to go into the details of the gauge fixing too much, but it's just a standard procedure. The point is that I can always use a gauge transformation, a complexified one, to actually set the connection to zero. That's what I was trying to say. So I can always say A bar is G inverse del bar G. I can always solve this equation. And if I do so, maybe A will become weird, but I don't care about A, it doesn't enter the action. So at the price of using a complexified gauge transformation, I can always remove the anti-holomorphic part of the connection. This is why mathematicians can talk about things called bundles, holomorphic bundles. So the point is that the anti-holomorphic part of a connection can always be removed locally. You might have, you know, you might not be able to do it globally, so you might have patches where you need to glue things by holomorphic gauge transformations. Now, this should totally remind you of string theory, okay? String theory, we had, remember, a metric, and we discovered that we could do diffeomorphisms and wild transformations to put it in a trivial form. And then locally, there were no degrees of freedom in the metric. There was only something global about how the surface was patched up together, which was complex structures. So here, the connection, again, can be eliminated locally, and globally, you get something called the space of bundles. I'm going to only do things locally here, on the sphere, that doesn't make a difference. But if you work on a complicated Riemann surface, this is part of the reason I'm not calling this a theory.
Is this what's called in mathematics Chern connection?
I don't know.
Okay.
So I can gauge fix A bar equal to zero. How do I do that? Well, I add a Lagrange multiplier. And then I add BC ghosts and make sure that there is a BRST symmetry and blah, blah, blah. Okay? If you remember, we are trying to write this as Q of something. I write it as Q of B, Z, A bar, where Q little b is big B. And Q of A bar is a gauge transformation with parameter the C ghost. And so you get del bar C. Well, really del bar plus A bar. Okay. And then you can integrate away. So there are these pair of fields which just enter quadratically. You can integrate them away. And you land with your final action. Now you got this ghost transform in the joint. And the only thing that happens to integrate away things is that before we had Q little b equal to big B. Now big B is set by the equations of motion of A bar to be the same as the currents for the G symmetry. So we have something like QZ is CZ. QC is CC, or meter 1/2. And QB is the currents, which are sort of ZZ plus commutator of C and B. I stopped putting gauge indices because I ran out of patience, but here you can put some structural constants and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Before I thought we were gauging a U1 symmetry, but now it seems we introduced the.
Why U1? Sorry.
There was no trace ever in the Z things. I didn't know there were matrices yet.
It's an A bar alpha beta.
Yeah, but the alpha beta indices, I thought they were the. I thought it was the internal symplectics.
Yes, the symmetry acts on internal indices.
Yeah. So the A.
If you need more indices, you can write it like perhaps this will help you.
No, but now we have commutators. If we have.
Does this help?
I guess.
If you cannot see, please come sit closer.
But I can. No. For instance, if Q.
Does this help? Do you understand what I wrote? So where I is an index for the adjoint.
First in the algebra, what's the algebra under consideration?
Do you want the name of it? I call it the group. I'll call it G. And the algebra, if I could do blackboard things, I would denote it like that.
I hadn't noticed that we had already introduced the gauge group.
I said I'm gonna gauge a symmetry of these symplectic bosons.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yes.
So it does.
These are the structural constants for the symmetry. It's that you have a symmetry acts on the fields.
Is this a spin to n symmetry?
Well, G, as I said, has to preserve the symplectic form.
Yes.
So the group does not have to be the symplectic group, but it has to live inside the symplectic group, preserving the symplectic form.
Okay.
Yes. And here, I put just a trace on the beginning. Sorry, that was my bad. And B's and C's transform the adjoint. So if I want that, I could write G of I, B, sorry, C of I, and B of I. Sorry, I was putting this as low for. This perhaps will help. And then when I write these expressions, well, I put an I here, jk, fi, jk. Well, these are the commutators, so the t's. And here you put your alpha, and here, sorry, I put the beta here, and I should have put the j here, and I should put the t, the I, sorry, I, alpha, beta. And here I should have put an I, a T I, alpha beta, and alpha beta. I don't know if I need a 1/2 actually, now that I think about it, possibly. Not sure. I need to remind myself in these notations. Maybe. Anyway. I'm not going to get the formula right anyway. And then T, F, I, J, K, C, J, B, K. Okay. So now we have all of the indices. Okay. Momentarily, I'm going to take this representation of the symplectic bosons to something very specific. I just wanted to give a general discussion of what gauge symplectic boson means. Now, this BRC symmetry will have to be implemented by, it's associated to a current. So there is a, which has a standard form. There is a trace of B CC plus C ZZ. And again, I leave the indices to your imagination. The charge, So now we could proceed in two ways. We could really try to stay in free field theory, in a sense. But sorry, I want to say this right, and I want to. So classically, this is always a sim. So this current has dimension one, and you can try to define the supercharge, BST charge, as the acting on some operator. At the origin, as by taking the current and integrating around the operator. Now, this requires a moment of caution. So I will put in one average bar here, too. The word of caution is the following. When I do this calculation, well, to do this calculation, I'll essentially do weak contractions to normal order and pick answers, OK? And there are sort of two terms that can contribute. I'll depict them graphically. I have my operator, which is a bunch of legs. And then there is the BRST current. So there is a term that is a single weak contraction. And then there is a term which has two weak contractions. OK? So let me call them Q0 and Q1. The total Q is the sum of this term, of these two. Notice that they have a different power of h bar in front, because this one has one more contraction. So the total Q. And furthermore, there was an h bar in the propagator and a 1 over h bar in the j. So the total q is q0 plus h bar q1. Okay. Now q0, you see, replaces a symbol with two symbols. And if you parse to the definition, or if you use better notations, it becomes clear that it's just this. Notice Q1 will act trivially if you only have on a single field. But Q1 will act on composite operators. So if you write an operator like that P and act with it on it with Q, there will be two terms. One is the classical transformations to the fields, and the other is the one loop correction.
Why there is no Q2? Why, like, you have three legs? You
can, because if I contract three things, I get a 1 over z cubed or higher. Mm-hmm. And there will be nothing left here. Mm-hmm. And I get 0. So actually, this one replaces a field with a derivative. So here, this field has a lot of, I'm going to have a lot of derivatives acting on it. Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, this q squared equal to 0. Now, follows from asking the qj is 0. And this has two terms. q0j equal to 0 and q1j equal to 0.
Okay. I'm a bit lost the same again.
Yes.
Why can't we attach three legs to the...
So let's do the calculation. So I'm going to get an integral of some power of z greater than 1, because I have at least three contractions.
Oh, yeah.
And then O 0, the z, and this is 0.
That's right.
So this statement is self-evident. Pretty much. Well, not completely, but 90% self-evident. It's just the fact that classically this is well-defined, engaging invariant. See, I'm just taking each individual field and doing the standard transformation with no fanciness. And it's just, the transformation is essentially a gauge transformation by C, except for one extra term. So This is gauge invariant, so all the things that contain C will just drop out. I need to just be careful that this doesn't mess up things, essentially. Actually, this is not exactly gauge transformation. Okay, you need to do it. It's a, and again, there is a, some very compact ways to do the calculation, but it works. Essentially, it had to work because of the BRST manipulations we did. Classically, there was no problem with what we were doing. The only problems can occur if the measure for the path integral is not invariant under gauge transformations. This problem gives you one loop problem. It propagates to the whole calculation. And at the end of the calculation, you discover that this is potentially non-zero. This is a number times trace of C del C. And that number, well, you can compute that number just by doing the calculation. Okay, there's going to be something like that, and then there's going to be the current itself. It's a one-loop diagram like that. No mysteries in that, in this diagram. You can, you want a C and a del C, so you, there are two things. You can have BC propagating, or you can have the Zs propagating. So at the end, you're going to count how many BCs you have and how many Zs you have, pretty much. So there is a certain, this number is something like a quadratic Casimir of the adjoint minus the quadratic Casimir of the Zs, of the representation we had, pretty much. So probably one half somewhere. Maybe I should put a 2 in front here, anyway. Okay. So you can cancel this in many ways. There are many gauge beta gamma systems that make sense. If you want to spice things up, you can even add some fermions to the story that will also contribute with opposite sign here and might help you make things work. But the theory we are interested in is some very specific choice. Where this cancellation happens just because the representation itself is the adjoint. Two adjoints, more precisely. So the final Carrel algebra has fields Z alpha, where alpha is now 1 or 2, which are also valued in the adjoint. And there are the B and Cs, which are valued in the joint, and they just cancel in the loops. So this is a well-defined theory. So the action is going to be integral of trace of Z alpha del bar Z beta epsilon alpha beta plus trace of B del bar C. Okay, and the OPEs are going to be, you know, the alpha, the beta, goes like epsilon alpha beta. I should probably put some edge adjoint indices now.
Do he live in a joint or in a joint plus a joint star?
Just a joint. There are two adjoints.
Do you mean one for Z, one for BC, or one for Z and another for it?
There is a Z1 and a Z2. Each of them is an adjoint. And then there is a B and C. Each of them is an adjoint. And so here I just need my pairing on the group. And then, okay. And in the following, we'll pick our group to be SUN. That's because this statement that Yes. So, because if I was to pick U1, I would just take, I would just have a bunch of fields in U1 that don't talk to anything else. So I'm just gonna ignore them. Now, working with SUN gives you a bit of unpleasantness here. Not too bad. But anyway, like in the sense that when you use your sort of double line notation in Feynman diagrams, you have to subtract traces occasionally. Or you can work with UN, that's also fine, makes no difference. Maybe I should keep UN so I don't have to worry too much about. But the U1, with understanding U1, the U1 part of the calculation would just drop out at the end. In this situation, it makes no difference. In more more complicated example of twisted holography, you really want to throw away the U1 parts because you might have bifundamental fields or things like that. And then the anomaly cancellation becomes annoying. You get contributions for U1 and for S1. Anyway, no matter.
Mm-hmm. When you did delta IU, like if these are matrices, don't I want to contract them?
For now, I was just writing a joint indices. I wrote a formula for general G. I apologize if that's confusing. I can rewrite the formula for for UN. That here will all of the indices.
Okay, sorry.
No problem. Okay. And this, whenever we draw Feynman diagrams now, we will use the double line notation to keep track of these contractions. Right, so your general operator now will look like something like that. And when you do contractions, you will keep track of things. Is the double line notation familiar to you? Reasonably familiar? So when I draw a picture like this, it just means, you know, each of these fields will have two indices. So this field had two indices, and I just draw this line to remember that this index was constructed with this, and index was constructed with this. The usefulness of the double line notation is that it allows the Tuft expansion. Okay? Because when you start contracting things, sometimes you're going to get closed loops of indices, which give a factor of n, and sometimes you don't. And if n is large, factors of n are big. So the Feynman diagrams, which have as many factors of n as possible, are going to be dominating the answer. So every calculation we'll do will have some power of h bar, and some power of n. And we will reorganize it to have some power of h bar and some power of h bar n, which you could call the Tuft coupling.
I think the two-point function should have the h bar upstairs, right?
Yes, of course. I don't know why I did this. I propagated it. I did a mistake once, and then I propagated everywhere, probably. No, over there, we're right. Yes, that's right. So indeed, so each contraction gives a factor of h bar. Each loop gives a factor of n. Okay. Now, one of the most important concepts in the truth expansion is that it's useful to organize operators. So the gauge invariant combinations of matrices are just polynomials in traces. And it's useful to study individual traces called single trace operators. So your single trace operator is going to be something that looks like a trace of a sequence. I will not call it P because P sounded like polynomial. I call it maybe W. It's a word. It's a sequence of things. The sequence of symbols that could be, you know, B, C. With derivatives. And there is a small subtlety there that. So, one important subtlety in the BRST analysis is that when you build operators, you are forbidden from using the zero mode of the C-ghost. So, operators always involve at least one derivative acting on the ghost. Discussing why that's the case is surprisingly tedious. Just take it as a rule at this point in your life, and you can try to understand why that rule is correct. If you don't do that, essentially, all that is going to happen is that you're going to have multiple copies of everything. Like when you study the BRST cohomology of your problem, trying to find operators which are Q-closed mode or Q-exact, including the zero mode of C, will only have the effect of giving you some stupid polynomials in C, which don't talk to anything else. And they are not physically relevant. So anyway, the rule for studying the local operators in BRST quantization is you take gauge invariant, G invariant, so expressions which are invariant under constant gauge transformations, modulo BRST, without including the zero mode of the ghosts. And so these sort of things are going to be polynomials in normal order polynomials in single traces. Up to trace relations, which we'll ignore because we're trying to work at large n. So all that I do, so I'm studying operators which has sort of size which remains bounded as I make n larger and larger. Maybe in later lecture we can study things like determinant of z, which has a size which grows with n as n increases and looks different for every value of n. Here I'm thinking about operators I can define uniformly in n. You know, expression makes sense for every n, so I can study the correlation functions for every n and write the answer as a polynomial in n. And then to reorganize it. So, and crucially for, okay, now there is a matter of conventions. There are two conventions we could use at this point. We could just do this, or we could put a 1 over h bar in front. These conventions both have their uses. This is a convention in which connected correlation functions go like 1 over h bar plus subleading corrections, 1 over h bar squared. I'll discuss this, okay? But this is one possible convention. This is also a convention which is natural if you think that your operator is something you're going to add to the theory to deform it. Right? So you can think about this as something you can add to the Lagrangian. So for example, if you're studying the volume theory of the brain and asking how this brain is affected by a bulk field, well, the coupling would be written as 1 over h bar, some operator on the brain, times the bulk field. So this is the thing that you multiply by a bulk field and insert in the action to describe the interactions between the brain and the rest of the universe. So let me call this OW for simplicity. Okay. And actually, I will devote quite some time in trying to repackage things in a more convenient way. But at the moment, I just want to say, I want to ask, how does the BRST transformation act on OW? Because the first question I should ask before I talk about an operator, I need to make sure it's BRST closed. So, well, remember those pictures that were, I think, in this blackboard? So there were two terms in Q. Now, I could repeat the same picture, except that now this operator is a single trace. So the indices run like this. So each line there became a double line. So these are my fields. Now, the three-level Q is harmless. That's something like that. It gives me something which still looks like a single trace operator. Okay? So I could say Q0 of OW is another single trace operator. Maybe I'll just write it as Q0 of W, just by definition. Okay? The one loop part, though, has two posts, can do two different things. So one possibility is that I'm contracting two things that are consecutive in the trace. Okay? This will give me a factor of h bar because it's Q1, but also a factor of n. And it will give me a single trace operator again. So when I act with Q1 on OW, one of the terms is going to be G, which, remember, is h bar n, or of, you could call it again Q1W. It's a new single trace operator. But there are other terms. I could have something horrible like this. Let me see. It's so horrible that I might have trouble drawing it. Something which is not planar. Now there is no factor of n anymore because there are no closed loops. Furthermore, let me follow the loop here. It goes like that and comes back. I could have had two things coming out. But the point is that this gives me sort of a single trace, and this gives me another single trace. So there is a correction here, which involves a normal order product of two operators. With some coefficients. Okay. But there is still an H bar in front, so it's subleading. So in the planar approximation, this is neglected. and not only these two effects.
Is this extra h bar compared to the notation on the left blackboard? Because you already have one h bar in front of q1 there.
Yes, I could have put a g in front of q1. Mm-hmm. This, the definition of this q1, the q1 is acting on operators. This is just a way, a mnemonic way for me to remember how it acts on labels. Mm-hmm. I gave it the same name because there are only so many names. But I could put a hat on it or a tilde. Or,
is it correct that both of them have extra h bar, but like in one case you have extra n? Which
that's right, which means it's,
yeah, it's absorbed,
finite
absorbs
in the tooth expansion.
So the other one is g over n, order g over n, the h bar guy.
I like to have h bar and g.
Okay, h, okay.
It's the saner way to do holography.
Okay.
Because h bar becomes the string coupling. I mean, it doesn't become, it was the string coupling to start with, and it never stops. And lambda is the back reaction. Another thing I can do is to try to do OPEs. Maybe I'll see Z1 and Z2, so not too many Ws. Now, let's draw some diagrams. I'm going to organize the answer. I don't want to do the calculation. I just want to figure out which powers of h bar and lambda will I encounter in this calculation. Okay. I have these operators with a bunch of x legs going out, and I'm trying to contract things. And the planar way to contract things is just to contract something and then a consecutive sequence of things. Of course, before I began contracting, this one thing I can do is to not contract anything, right? Meaning the OPE has singular terms, but then at some point it starts having finite stuff. There is one finite thing, which is OW1 OW2, normal ordered and still evaluated at Z and W if you want. So if I, when I do OP with contractions, I'm applying with theorem. So there is always going to be something left, which is just the normal ordering of the two expressions. Okay. This one is bigger than anything I'm going to write here in a very concrete sense. Simply because, you know, these are big things. There is a 1 over h bar in front, right? And I chew these big things. Then I start doing contractions. If I do one contraction, I get an h bar factor, but it kills one of the 1 over h bars. So I'll have a first term, which is order 1 and a single trace. Then there will be a term with two contractions done in a planar manner. This will give me a lambda. And again, a single trace. Then I can do something with three contractions in a planar way. So each contraction has an h bar and has an n. So it adds a lambda. No, not lambda, g. I was calling it g. G squared. All the way until I do all of the contractions, if these were both the same size. So this is not an infinite series. It will stop at something like g to the size. I'm not even ordering the terms in the usual way in the OP. Clearly, the more contractions I do, the higher the divergence. So this is typically going to be the most divergent part, and the lower and lower degree of divergence. But I'm not even writing the divergences because, you know, I'm not specifying what I'm contracting. Maybe there are derivatives of fields. Who knows? And then the non-planar stuff can be included. non-planar stuff will have multi-traces. It's not planar, so you'll get H bar non-planar. So if I work in the planar approximation, this is all garbage I throw away. I had this leading thing, which is not singular at all. And then, slightly subleading, the planar singularity. OK? If you have Carl algebras in mind, the planar limit can actually be a little bit confusing. That's not too bad. See, the point is that when you look at two-point functions of things, the two-point functions go like one over h bar squared. The three-point functions go like one over h bar squared. The four-point functions, we have a connected and a disconnected part. The disconnected part goes like one over h bar to the fourth, and the connected one like one over h bar squared. So in the planar approximation, all correlation functions are kind of blowing up if you normalize operators like this. And the OPEs remain finite. If you omit this, then all correlation functions are finite, but you lose all the singularities. Like the correlation functions just collapse to completely disconnected products of two-point functions.
This is something like Kreutzer-Glien show when they provide reality. Some limits like this of W algebra.
Right, that's right. So this is kind of a classical limit of a Carl algebra. So the planar approximation is a classical limit for the Carl algebra, which shouldn't surprise you at all because, you know, on the holographic dual side, we have this Cordara-Spencer theory, and we're taking a classical limit. Right, there was a h bar squared is the coupling of Cordara-Spencer theory. So, nothing to be surprised about, but just something to keep in mind, that the planar limit of the Carl algebra is some kind of a Poisson Carl algebra, something where you get a Poisson bracket, you get sort of the leading in OP, it's linear, very nice. And you get a product, but a sort of scale in different ways. It's like when you have if you look from quantum mechanics to classical mechanics, right? The observables, the product of observables in quantum mechanics is a classical part plus h bar the Poisson bracket. So if I were to not include the h bar here, then here you would have that this product is a classical thing plus h bar times this. So this is the analog of a Poisson bracket in quantum mechanics, and it's the analog of the classical product. Now here we're doing a Carl algebra, not a quantum mechanics, but it's a similar spirit. It's another message I wanted to. Now is it 1 hour or 1.5? I have no idea. I can keep going arbitrarily long, but.
We were doing 1 hour. But.
Okay. Perhaps then I should. This seems to be a reasonable place to stop to. And one word I can say, right, sorry, is that you can imagine also turning off G. If you really want to simplify things as much as possible, you would say take the planar approximation, and I also take G very small. And then everything comes from a single weak contraction. And you know, we should be able to do holography in the leading order in the back reaction. No, with no back reaction at all, essentially. So what I want to do next time is to see how do I possibly reconcile this calculation with the calculation in the bulk. And then how can I hope to get the rest? And I'm focusing on OPE, partly because in the paper with Kevin, we focused on correlation functions a lot. and you know, P is two. There's this global symmetry algebra part. It's very fun. I don't know if Kevin has discussed it. I would probably aim for that. Anyway, any questions?
So this leading order will correspond to taking Godard-Spencer's theory, non-back reactive geometry, and putting some operators on the boundary, simple.
Yes, I mean, although the word operators on boundary, right, means really modifications of boundary conditions.
Yes.
Yeah. So I take Godard-Spencer's theory in C3, pretty much.
C3.
Mm-hmm. Kind of. Not exactly C3, like C3 minus the location of the brain. And I'm just sending, but I don't care. The calculation is just literally what I was drawing on the board. I take some boundary conditions, some fuzzy wave functions that sort of would couple to operators on the brain. And you can show that you take two of these fuzzy wave functions, and you try to take both at the same time. There is a nonlinearity, and you get three terms. Like the product of the two plus an extra one. Sorry, the sum of the two plus a combined one. The sum of the two is something that sort of goes and touches two separate points on the brain, and is this term. And the third one is sort of an extra tail which corrects that and reproduces this. And then you start back reacting. Well, everything gets messed up if you know, the things that you're sending in get deformed by the back reaction, and the way they interact gets deformed by the back reaction. So everything needs to be adjusted. Alternatively, you could just work in the fully back reacted geometry and do the sort of calculations I was doing with Kevin. Either way, in principle, you should be able to reproduce that, although this is not. We did not do it. Ken Ju has a paper where he sort of start doing it at the first order, I think. Sort of computes the back reaction in SL2C that would justify this term. He matches, yeah, I think matching the first is kind of automatic, but we'll try to do it in the lecture. And this, the second one is already a non-trivial Witten diagram. In the dual geometry, I shouldn't call it a Witten diagram because you're not really back reacted. You're doing things order by order in back reaction, so it's just a diagram of Godard-Spencer theory in C3. And then there is this notion of the global symmetry algebra, which takes a piece of this calculation, which is more manageable. And which can be matched to, which sort of looks at the symmetries of this chiral algebra instead of looking at the chiral algebra itself. And the symmetries can be matched on the other side. And presumably matching the symmetries imply that the chiral algebra is also matched, but I don't know. Or constraints.
Mm-hmm.
From the physical picture that you gave us earlier,
yes,
of the waves coming in,
mm-hmm,
so this perturbative expansion of the chiral algebra,
yes,
is in some sense something like if I have an integral with three or four kernels,
mm-hmm,
and I try to expand that in some power series where the first term is linear, the first term is no contractions.
Right. So when you right, the thing with the three kernel was sort of in the leading approximation,
mm-hmm,
but the equations of gravity are not linear. So saying that you have a three kernel is not really, a product of three kernels is wrong, or two kernels. There is something which in perturbation theory is the product of two kernels plus a single kernel which has two incoming wave functions and give one outgoing one. That is the thing which sort of controls the OPE.
It's an aspect of the scaling that I wanted just to nail down. So from what I understood, for instance, the normal order with two O's should go as 1 over H bar squared, I presume, because O's goes as 1 over H bar.
I mean, saying what So, yeah, I think it's correct to say that all goes like 1 over h bar.
Okay.
One way to show it is that the two-point function of OO is some function of g times 1 over h bar squared. Yes.
Okay.
That's right.
And therefore, okay, these planar terms go as 1 over h bar because there is one contraction which generates an h bar and one of the other h bar is still remaining.
Well, they go like operators, which are order one of h bar, yes.
Exactly. Okay. They go like operators. Because all of this is to emphasize, because at some point, it seems you're mentioning something that the scaling of correlation function was different from one.
But I'm happy also to not put this.
Yeah.
So as I said, these are conventions. Both have advantages. Even in every string theory textbook, also this convention changes a bit. You know, do I want scattering amplitudes to be coupling to the 2g minus 2? Or do you want to cut it to the 2g minus 2 plus n, where n is the number of punctures? Both have advantages. One corresponds to doing this, and the other corresponds to doing this.
Okay.
If you omit this, then you gain an h bar here.
Okay.
And then this is like the Poisson bracket in quantum mechanics. It's the quantum correction to the product of things.
Okay.
So there is a product which is non-singular, naive. The one that you would have ignoring normal order. And then there is an h-bar contract correction to that.
Okay. So the remark about the difference between correlation functions and OBs was not an intrinsic difference, but just a convention difference. Like, if you emphasize something about the correlation functions...
Yes. So typically you want to normalize operators to 1, right?
Okay.
Or to something finite. To do that, then you will not put this 1 over h-bar.
Okay.
Yes. And perhaps I should have done that. I just get... You know, I fluctuate. Every time I prepare a lecture, I say, no, I should do the other thing. And it just happened that today I woke up with 1 over h bar.
Can I ask a silly question?
Yes.
Initially, we started with the definition of the beta-gamma system. We started with the symplectic form.
Yes.
W, and then at some point, we switched to the Lebesgue-Vita tensor.
Yes.
I think I missed why we did.
Which Lebesgue-Vita, sorry?
We started writing the propagator as epsilon alpha beta.
Epsilon alpha beta delta ij. So the alphas over there are a combination of this 1-2 index and of the adjoint. So there is sort of an omega, let me write like I1 alpha 1, I2. Alpha 2, which is epsilon alpha 1 alpha 2 delta I1 I2 spelled out fully. I should probably use some capitalized letters up there, but for the indices to avoid the confusion. Mm-hmm.
The thing that you explained now about the symmetry algebra?
Yes.
Does that exist also in the n equals 4 case? Because it's an algebra that is inside
no.
The correlation functions.
I would say, should I say no? Yes and no. So in n equals 4 supermules, you have the stress tensor, which has integral dimension and is a conserved quantity. And that's definitely dual to something on the other side, which is diffeomorphism of near the boundary. But here it's a chiral algebra, and so in a chiral algebra, every local operator gives you a symmetry, infinite, you know, gives you symmetries. And so because of this feature, you're supposed to find a lot of symmetries on the other side too. And Kolder-Rasmussen's theory is this symmetry, which is holomorphic vector fields. And so you can try to match these two things.
But I thought maybe this is a misunderstanding of me, but I thought that twisted holography, one of the conjectures is that this is going to be like some subset of the full.
So it's perfectly possible for a subsector to have a symmetry which is not shared by the full theory.
So you said something like that the OP captures a partial bracket, so can I somehow quantize like using a one-dimensional QFT like on a line? Because like QM is one-dimensional.
Well, so one way to encode the chiral algebra is a vertex algebra. A vertex algebra is an algebra with some special properties. In that language, the classical limit is really the classical limit of an algebra that becomes a commutative algebra plus a Poisson bracket. So you get what's called the vertex Poisson algebra or a Poisson vertex algebra. The two terms are different, and I don't know which one is which.
And this algebra lives in like a 1D QFT or something? Because if I want like, because if I view quantum mechanics as like a 1D QFT, then I'm...
Yeah, so when you describe it to the chiral algebra as a vertex algebra, what effectively you've done is to take the chiral algebra on the cylinder and treat it as one-dimensional theory by replacing a field by the Kaluza-Klein modes. See, a vertex algebra is an algebra of the Fourier modes of the fields. This algebra has an extra structure which makes it a vertex algebra, which is this vacuum module, so-called. The vacuum module corresponds to the fact that you can take you can make the complex plane into a cigar, so that it looks like a boundary condition for a 1D system. So now you have the algebra modes, and then you have the local operators at the tip, which give you a module for the algebra modes. So when you read the axioms of vertex algebra are the same, essentially that you have a quantum mechanical system which is secretly a C star. And it's equipped with a boundary condition, which is secretly a complex plane seen as a cigar.
But isn't it like some to the QFT Poisson bracket?
It's a structure. So there is a notion of classical chiral algebra. Classical chiral algebra is a collection of fields with non-singular product, but equipped with a singular bracket, which is the classical limit of the OPE.
I was also confused about what you said about normal ordering not being like the usual vertex algebra normal order.
Yes. See,
how is it even possible if you want to write some B?
The dot, dot, dots were weak contractions. These weak contractions had, you know, powers of 1 over Z minus W, but then there were still some Zs and Ws inside the operators. Mm-hmm. When you rewrite this as an OPE, you need to do a Taylor series expansion every time you see a Z replaced with a W.
So the difference, but...
So you get, you know, singular stuff, but also extra finite stuff.
Substance record. So the difference between like this and the like, usual vertex algebra one is substance regular.
Yes, that's right. So there are regular in the sense of weak contraction is not the same as regular in the sense of OPE.
Mm-hmm.
But is it regular? Because when you Taylor expand, the operator's there. Like,
now, there will be, of course, the singular part of the OPE is still there. But I'm saying, besides the singular part of the OPE, there will also be regular terms in the Taylor expansion.
No, yeah. But even in the singular parts, those are also evaluated at different points.
But now you Taylor expand, so they're evaluated at the same point.
Yes, but they generate extra singular terms.
Absolutely. I agree.
Yeah.
The terms that... A given singular term will refuse contribution from many different contraction patterns. That's right. So, indeed, there is a tension between the sort of the free field theory and the OPE description of the system. Which can be encoded in various ways. I could probably say words involving BVE bracket or something. but I don't think they will be terribly helpful. And you know, here is just only part of the theory. That the full system involves also the normal order product of a bunch of traces, which they had their own OPEs, which in the planar approximation though only involves traces pairwise, single traces pairwise, I think. No, but this sentence might be not even true. No, right, has extra terms now, because now I could have connected diagrams which glue together multiple traces into a single one. So if I wanted to give you the full structure, I would have had to tell you when I do OPE of multi-trace things, I find terms with lower number of traces too.
So there's no like filtration by number of traces.
No, that's right, that's right. Although, yeah, now I don't remember if it's, so I don't, now I don't remember if giving you this data at the planar limit gives you everything or if you need more. Yeah, because naively I can get something that has two traces and a single trace, and I have contractions which spits out a single trace. That's a thing. For example, the BST differential acting on multi-traces is not just the BST differential acting on each individual one. There are terms where the differential, the two legs of Q1 attach to the two different traces. So it's not even true that in the planar approximation, the algebra is just product of single trace things. It could be product of single trace things which are not actually Q-closed and need to be corrected. It's only if you take both planar approximation and tooth coupling to zero, then you get this sort of polynomials in single traces. So that's something to keep in mind, perhaps. If you try to define the product of single traces via normal order, the alternative is that you try to define the product of single trace, multi-trace operators as regularized products in the sense of chiral algebra. If you do that, then the BST chart satisfies Leibniz. And then, so the regularized product of two single traces that are Q-closed is still Q-closed. So that's a saner way to go. But these regularized products have unpleasant features, like it's not associative, blah, blah, blah. But fine, it's a thing. You can axiomatize it. So this Poisson chiral algebra site have a regularized product and a Poisson OPE, which satisfies certain axioms, and that's what this structure will give you. So, normal order single trace operators, together with regularized products of them. And I hope by next week I hopefully have a clear idea of how that looks like in the dual. I haven't thought about it. I was just thinking about single traces and the OPE.
Speaking of the dual, I was wondering if you could say how one goes from the chiral algebra to the geometry.
Meaning, how do I discover the geometry? Well, that's its own paper rather than, but it's definitely something I'm working on now. So, but next week we'll do the toy. We'll do it at least at this order. This order I can show it to you. So there is a purely algebraic construction, which allows you to see the tensor geometry out of the chiral algebra. So there is a way to really see the holomorphic functions in the tensor geometry, or the vector fields of the tensor geometry, or things like that. All I'm really saying, it's not deep, okay, is that, as I said, if you work at the complete leading order, then the holographic dual is simply C times the transverse geometry to the brain. And the calculations in that geometry must be reproduced by this completely silly calculation when I do a single weight contraction. There cannot be any combinatorial mystery, right? If two things are equal and they're so simple, they must be manifestly equal. And so, I'm gonna try to show that. There's a little bit of two-dimensional topological field theory on the worksheet going on. It's like, topological field theories can be rediscovered from small amounts of data. So, in a sense, you just look at the chiral algebra calculation, you recognize that it's a calculation in the worksheet theory, and then you say, this is the same calculation that in the worksheet theory would give me the bulk calculation. But somehow there are easy and hard calculations. So Kodaira-Spencer theory is a complicated field theory, right? Has the bars and anti-holomorphic forms and whatnot. So whenever Kodaira-Spencer theory tries to explore all of a space, calculations are hard. But sometimes, if you're just trying to explore the little neighborhood of some place, of a point, calculations become much more algebraic, much simpler. So in a sense, at the very leading order, you're not exploring much direction parallel to the brain. You're just doing some very silly calculation very close to the brain in the transverse direction. And so everything is very algebraic. There are no mysterious, complicated anti-holomorphic forms ever. No forms are armed in the process. Everything can be done with polynomials and algebra. There is no, right, there are calculations you can do with algebra and calculations that require analysis. Okay? So to look at Kodaira-Spencer theory, you need analysis, typically. You need to find the propagator, integrate Feynman diagrams over space-time. Analysis is hard, always. Even if it's analysis in algebraic geometry, it's still hard. But sometimes you can do things with elementary algebra. So there is a piece of Kodaira-Spencer theory which you can do with elementary algebra. And in this calculation, only that piece ever appears. And the farther you go from there, the more you're trying to explore the analysis of the problem. And I really want to be able to do everything with algebra. That's the project that I'm trying to work on without ever mentioning analysis as much as possible, because I don't want to do Feynman diagrams in SL2C.
One evidence of the mentioned which Kevin presented us last time was like global symmetries.
Yes.
Two actions, SL2R.
That's right. The global symmetry is a very algebra, right?
Yeah, but it's algebra, but it's not something like in a small neighborhood on SO2C. It's something global. It's global property.
Yeah, it's global. That's right. I said small neighborhood, but perhaps saying something global would have been better. The word global would have been better.
Yes.
So global stuff in an affine variety are holomorphic functions, algebra. It's easy. Whenever you need to do cohomology with zero n forms, that things become hard.
Mm.
So the more propagators you have in the game, the harder it is to do the calculation. You have zero and forms everywhere. The leading calculation sort of has no internal propagators.
But does the in-order computation here know about the global symmetries?
Sorry?
Does the leading order computation here knows about global symmetries? This was
no. So, well, the leading order knows global symmetries of C3 minus the origin.
Okay.
Or equivalently, really, if one were globally on CP1, knows the symmetries of the conifold.
Mm-hmm.
And then the corrections deform that to the symmetries of the deformed conifold.
So these two SL2Cs, they are mixed in different orders in G?
No. No, what do you mean?
I mean, like, if you tell that, like, in non-backreactive geometry, these two SL2Cs, do they act properly, or are they only present in a deformed geometry?
No, no, so the conifold has SL2Cs and
has
SL2 times SL2 symmetry. And so does the deformed conifold.
So it's not like emergent symmetry. It's
no, indeed. So that's what makes the story easier. That mm-hmm. the conformal symmetry is not emergent
mm-hmm. okay.
at low energy. The conformal symmetry is there, baked in from the very beginning. The chiral algebra is there, no matter how small the tooth coupling is.
Mm-hmm.
And the dual geometry, in a sense, has this true symmetry. It's either the conifold or the deformed conifold with the deformation, which is G.
When we include more terms in our calculation,
yes.
of higher power in G, the corresponding geometry would be some deformed geometry. That's not C3. It's
yes.
C3 plus deformation.
Mm-hmm.
Is that deformation, in some sense, global or localized deformation on the geometry side?
Computational deformations are always global, in a sense. They change the algebra functions and things like that. But they're described by a Beltrami differential, which is, you know, a function of your, it's, you know, it's a zero one form value in vector fields. So you can use a check description where you say, okay, take a manifold, like chop it. In each piece, the Beltrami differential is zero, but I glue the pieces in a deformed way. Or you can sort of brave the 0-1 forms and do calculation with 0-1 forms.
But there is some sense in which the new complex structure, the deformed complex structure, is close to the original one, right?
Yes. Yeah, the deformed conifold is the deformation of the conifold. But the limit is a bit singular.
Okay.
Right, the deformed conifold only has functions. It's an affine space. It's defined by an equation in C4. But when you take the limit, the equation is singular. There's a singularity which in the original geometry was actually a little CP1, the location of the brain. So there is a phenomenon going here that which I don't understand, so I don't want to talk about it until I understand it. I need to understand it, which is that the deformation actually makes the problem better. So I still don't understand in which sense that statement is true. So, like, I had the feeling that, you know, I don't know exactly the specific meaning of these words, but I feel that, for example, this extra term in the Q might actually be killing a little bit of garbage. Like, I'm not sure though, I need to check. Yeah, I don't know. I need to understand that. I'm a little confused.
Can I think of G as, in some sense, the size of the deep brain?
No, it's the size of the... So this deformed conifold is a tricycle. In Kolasman's theory, there is a notion of size of a tricycle, which is the integral of the tree form on the tricycle. And that's G. There are other ways you could think about it, but this is a good one.
And like, there is no link between this story and story about geometric transition.
There totally is.
Okay.
So Wafa, Wafa have papers, right? And they focus a lot on the geometric transition in the A model.
Yeah,
in A model, you start from the deformed conifold, you put brains on a tree, and you go to the conifold.
Yes.
But there is a paragraph in which they discuss the opposite, where you start with the conifold, you put in the B model, you put brains on CP1, and it's back reacted to the deformed conifold.
Oh.
They claim.
Okay.
It's not a calculation, it's just saying this fact.
I see.
It's a very useful perspective.
So it's mirror picture at all. Not mirror, but like...
I don't know if it's mirror symmetry at all.
It's not mirror, but like dual in a sense. Opposite way.
It's the same. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's A and B twist with different brains, right? So it's different too.
Mm-hmm.
And so the original story was about Chern-Simons theory. They had Chern-Simons theory on S3 with very specific observables.
Mm-hmm.
And you can write an holographic dual, which is type 2A in the conifold.
Mm-hmm.
The holographic dictionary is subtle, but it can be made to work. It is an example of this holography too, just that it involves the A model. A model is hard because it has instantons.
Yeah.
So A model is not as, it's not a, yeah. It's harder to do things.
Yeah, but okay.
So paradoxically, this would have been a simpler example.
Yeah, so in a sense, it was easier for them to compute things in Chern-Simons theory because it allows you to take into account everything non-perturbatively. Yes?
Yes.
Because it goes in Q, expansion in Q.
That's right, you're correct. But then most of the effects that you match are non-perturbative.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Worksheets, wrapping essentially the CP1 in the conifold.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, did you say that again?
Well, in the A model, there are instantons. They come from curves wrapping holomorphic curves. Worksheets wrapping holomorphic curves. The conifold has a CP1 that can be wrapped. And so you get instanton effects where the strings wrap the CP1. Weighted by some Q, which is e to the 2 pi I times the tooth coupling, which in Chern-Simons language, is e to the 2 pi I n over k. So the calculations in Chern-Simons theory, everything is, you did Wilson line, put Wilson lines or stuff like that. You use topological field theory to do calculations. You end up with polynomials in this e to the 2 pi I over level. And then the Lagrangian limit, this should admit a reorganization. And the Lagrangian limit, k is going to scale like n, and the ratio of the true is going to be the tooth coupling, which means the q goes to 1, but q to the n is finite. So you need to take whatever calculations you do with the color of those polynomials or whatnot. These are functions. These are always complicated functions of q. They can be written in a uniform way in n as polynomials in q and q to the n. And then you're going to take a limit where q goes to 1 and q to the n is finite. And this, you know, if you want q is, and this should match the calculations done on the other side in the A model. These calculations will have the usual string coupling, which is the usual, it's still 1 over k, it hasn't changed. And we'll have the instanton counting parameter, which is the area of CP1, which is e to the minus area of CP1, which is this q to the n. So it's a, I don't think people, it is, this was written long ago, so if you read the way it's written, it might not be stated in these holographic terms, but it can be done in a straightforward manner. Yeah, I don't know if there are interesting generalizations. Like which other holographic, which other examples of twisted holography you could produce in a similar way from 3D TFTs and A model. I mean, here there are all sorts of variants where you take chiral algebras associated to brains that live in some not complicated transverse geometry. In type 2A, you have interesting transverse geometry. So you have three-dimensional brains. There is a transverse R3. You could maybe quotient that R3. I'm not sure it's. I don't know if there are interesting three-dimensional singularities you can put brains at the tip of. And also, Trans-Simons theory is quite, it's kind of, is not easy to generalize. Well, you can, you could have Trans-Simons, I mean, in a way that remains topological. I don't know if Trans-Simons theory has many topological cousins.
BGM is not supersymmetric enough.
It's not topological. You could do a topological twist of BGM, you're perfectly correct.
Yeah.
I don't know how that looks like. It's possible that it looks close to a Trans-Simons for a supergroup, but I'm not sure.
A BGM, you mean?
Yeah, maybe not.
So it's a Trans-Simons coupled with some adjoint matter.
Yeah, I know. If you do a topological twist.
In this case, I don't know.
I think it's conceivable that it becomes some kind of Trans-Simons with a supergroup, or.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure. Might be interesting to figure out.
And for a BGM, people consider usual holography as far as they know. They compute, they have some holographic computation.
I mean, instead of a BGM, you said the words ADHM n equal 4, ADHM n equal 4, which flows to the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then you could totally say I take the holomorphic twist, the A of B twists
mm-hmm.
of 3D n equal 4 theories, which flow to the theory of the two brains, often two brains really, but the dual of that is twisted, supposed to be M theory in some geometry, it's not type 2A. So I think you're correct, it's really in the ABGM to go to get the type 2A.
Mm-hmm.
And ABGM twists of ABGM, I don't think have been, I vaguely remember a recent paper. But I think it's mostly an open question, how twists of a BGM look like.
I haven't seen much on twists of a BGM. People typically perceive it as a conformal theory.
Mm-hmm.
They treat it in this way.
But it could be fun to twist it and
mm-hmm.
and try to look at the type 2A dual, a type A dual.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how the geometry look like. Like ABGM usually is like well, it is 3 times. In ABGM it's very confusing because you don't know any brains which give you ABGM. Like the dual geometry is ADS 4 times CP3.
Yeah.
That doesn't look like the near horizon limit of something.
Mm-hmm.
what I do, a cone over CP3, maybe. That's a weird geometry. Now, if you do an, if you twist this whole the whole thing, the three-dimensional theory will give you quantum mechanics of some sort. If you do, now there's also the problem of finding interest. You know, when you do twists of 3D n equal 4, I don't know. Putting them on the one, putting those on a manifold doesn't look like the natural thing to do.
What number of spinners do you need?
I mean, you can do a straight partition function, correlation function on a straight.
Yeah.
That you can do.
It's 3 years.
I wouldn't do complicated with some lines. So it does look a lot like Charles Simons.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe there is some kind of story there. It's open.